I'm David Manilow. Welcome to The Dining Table, a place where we gather to share the good things in life. Once again on this episode, Ali Marati from the Cranes Newsroom will be here. She'll introduce us to a new feature for the users of Talk, the reservation platform. Plus, I'll chat with a guy who's always in great spirits. AJ Heidendell runs high-end auctions, mostly for whiskey. And a recent auction included a bottle of bourbon that was sold for more than $48,000.
Yeah, obviously that's a special circumstance. We don't see those come around every day, but some of the small releases and very special products that came out around the turn of the century are really kind of having their moment in the sun.
You know, Edgewater is starting to have a really great restaurant scene, so I headed over to the 5700 block of North Broadway to check out Sfera, which is Sicilian street food. Right on the corner, a cute, tiny little place, just got a handful of seats in the counter. They specialize in arancini. You can get two for $11. They have four different kinds, classico, porcini, wild garlic, and then they have a roasted red pepper. They also have sfincioni, which is like a thick crust Sicilian pizza. They have four kinds of that. By the way, if you get two arancinis and one of these sfincionis, it's way too much food for one person. A charming place, nice people, really good food. Daniela Vitale is one of the owners. She is Sicilian, cute little place. But it reminded me how good the Edgewater restaurant scene. So I'm just going to take you on the strip heading north from Sfera. You've got a vegan place. You've got two Ethiopian spots. You've got Masa Ala del Sol, which is the sister to Los Napolis, which was in Lincoln Square forever. You have Chengdu Impressions, which I've been eating at for a long time at their Halstead location. Try the dry chili chicken with the numbing peppercorns. Really, really good. But it's very good Sichuan food there. A couple of doors down, you've got Moody's Pub that has been there for 63 years. I've had many more blue cheeseburgers than I care to claim. Patio in the summer, really dark inside the rest of the time. And if you want dessert, cute little place called Lickety Split, and then take a nap. So you could do some good eating on Broadway in Edgewater.
Crane's Ali Marati joins us on the latest in the restaurant and food beat. Hey, Ali.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
So Talk, the kind of online restaurant and more reservation system, has something new.
Yes, they launched a wine shop. It's called Talk Wine Shop. And they're starting with bottles from 30 wineries, but they have big plans to add hundreds more wineries. And, you know, this is sort of stemming from Talk. As you said, it's a restaurant reservation platform. They've been around since 2014. They've had a big couple years, which we can get into later. But in 2016, they started doing reservations, not just for restaurants, but for wine tastings at wineries. And this is around the country, around the world. And so this is sort of an extension of that, you know, and giving those wineries an easier way to sell their wine directly to consumers, because it's a little clunky to buy wine online these days. And then there's sort of this complicated three-tier system, which is the way of distributing alcohol in the U.S. that kind of traces its roots back to Prohibition. And a lot of people in the industry say that it's antiquated and clunky. And so Talk said that this wine shop is kind of, you know, one way to help the wineries circumnavigate that, make it a little easier for them, and continue to boost their business, which I think they've done a lot of during the pandemic. You know, Talk, they sort of really saw the pandemic coming, if that makes sense, because they were operating around the world. Talk CEO and founder Nick Kokonis, who is of Alinea fame, has said that he was sort of watching, you know, the pandemic hit other countries first and what was happening to their restaurants there. And so immediately rolled out this Talk to Go platform. So a bunch of more restaurants, it kind of got away from just the high-end restaurants, and a bunch of restaurants hopped on board to this. And the wineries, I think in particular, started doing a lot more scheduling, you know, of tastings when they could do that sort of thing again. So they said that over the past 2 years, the platform has seen 175% increase in bookings for events, tours, tastings at wineries. So this is sort of something to lead into that increased demand.
Right. But so if I understand this, this wine shop is just a way for Talk to kind of curate a bunch of really interesting wineries all over the place and have
consumers be able to go to Tock and just order the wine directly from these wineries, which you can do now, and I have done in the past. You can find a winery that you like. But I think what this does is give you kind of like one-stop shopping on Tock, and they're kind of letting you know what's out there, how you can do it. It seems very simple.
Totally. That's exactly right. And I think for consumers, you obviously have a lot of them kind of trust the Tock brand at this point. They know that they're going to curate something that's cool and high end, you know, like they have with the restaurants on the platform, that sort of thing. And, you know, the other thing is that Tock has hundreds of thousands of users around the world. If you add these hundreds of wineries in there, it is definitely kind of bringing together, you know, the demand and the supply in one place, if that makes sense. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how it grows. They've trialed this before. Previously, they did like a holiday wine shop. They do e-commerce a little bit with some of their restaurants selling cookbooks or pantry items, that sort of thing. But it is largely newish for them.
Sure. But I think they probably recognized a need, and they saw that, you know, the wineries aren't really equipped necessarily to do this on a major kind of e-commerce way. And Tock is. And so it's just like, seems like a pretty good marriage.
Right. And so we mentioned Nick Kokonis as one of the co-founders. Another person who's been involved in this since the get-go is Brian Fitzpatrick. And he was a big brain behind Google, you know, back in the day. And so the tech platform here is really robust, is the point that I'm trying to make. And they can do a lot with it. Additionally, Tock just got bought last year by Squarespace for $400 million. So they've seen a lot of growth. They've got this huge infusion of money to do a lot of new things. Their employee count has gone through the roof. It's grown almost 140% over the last 2 years. They're up to 270 employees almost. They just moved into this big new office in Fulton Market. So you're seeing a lot going on there. I wouldn't be surprised if this isn't the last new offering that we see come out of Tock.
Well, right. Because you, as you mentioned before, they're pretty good at pivoting and also taking advantage of markets. And I'm sure with Nick, he kind of analyzes all the data. He sees what's out there. And then he says, this is the next place. And when they pivoted during a pandemic, the early stages, I mean, restaurants jumped on board for the same reason, because they realized that nobody was coming in. They're not equipped to do a to-go reservation system. And when Tock came to this, I mean, I think there was like an outpouring of thanks from restaurants all over the country.
Oh, yeah. And when you have that system, it wasn't just the to-go, right? It was when restaurants opened again, you know, throughout 2020, 2021, it was the contact tracing that was given by this kind of robust tech back end that they had there, because they were doing the reservations and they would get the contacts that way. You know, so you see a lot of that going on. I think also just with the movement toward online that happened so much during the pandemic as it pertains to ordering your food and going out to eat, right? We saw a big push for that from breweries and wineries and the alcohol makers as well, because their tap rooms and their tasting rooms, not to mention all the bars, you know, and restaurants where they sold their products, were closed. So a lot of them were kind of pushing back on the alcohol distribution system as it existed and saying, hey, we need other outlets to get to the consumers. We can't just be doing this big clunky thing where we sell to the distributors who then sell to the retailers who then sell to the consumers, because consumers on their part were wanting to do everything online too. You know, they started buying their groceries online, started buying their restaurant food online. They wanted to buy their alcohol online too. And I think that there's a lot more savviness out there and that a lot of those habits have stuck.
Just back to the wine. I have taken advantage of wineries in the past where if I've seen a bottle, I've liked it. And it's kind of exciting when you just get, you know, two bottles, four bottles, six bottles from a winery, whether it's in California or Oregon or wherever. And I am also in the past, and still am, in a wine club, but it's only with one winery. It's not one of these wine clubs that just sources from all different places and you get whatever, because I really like their wines. And it shows up, you know, I think six bottles show up twice a year. And that's fun. And then you drink them.
Yep. You enjoy them. And yeah, I think too, you know, some of these wineries, I've been to wineries in California where, you know, you have to buy a case to make it worth your money to ship it right. back. And I think that this will help out with people that maybe don't have room in their apartment to put a whole case of wine or whatever the case may be. You know, it'll be interesting to see how this grows and, you know, kind of what the speed of adaptation is, I guess.
I think whatever the case may be is a perfect way of putting it. All right, Allie, until next time, thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
I'm here with AJ Heindel, co-founder of Unicorn Auctions, based here in Chicago. Hey, AJ, how's it going?
I'm good, David. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm going to describe your site. You hold auctions at least once a month. You feature all kinds of bottled spirits. It's dominated by whiskey, especially bourbon. And for those who don't know this market and you're listening, the last time I looked at one of your auctions, 40 bottles of whiskey on Unicorn auction sites sold for more than $2,000 each. And one of them sold for $48,500. Okay, tell me about that bottle because I am fascinated by that.
Yeah, obviously that's a special circumstance. We don't see those come around every day, but... like you said, the bourbon market in the United States, as well as the domestic rye market, has really taken off over the last number of years. And some of the small releases and very special products that came out around the turn of the century are really kind of having their moment in the sun. And that bottle is a great example of that. It's known to the world as the Linnell's Red Hook Rye. Linnell is a very famous individual in the bourbon whiskey community. She owned a liquor store in Brooklyn in Red Hook for a long time, kind of like an unofficial bourbon hall of famer. And this was, yeah, again, right around the turn of the century, just after 2000. And it was a batch of domestic rye whiskey that was chosen by Linnell and a couple other hall of famers. Michael Veach is a big name in the bourbon community as well. He was involved in the picking of these certain barrels. But basically, it was... four separate barrels and batches that they put together that were consolidated from a number of other barrels that were very low, 23-year age statement. So over the course of 23 years, the whiskey in the barrel, if you don't know, can kind of get pretty low down. And the barrels sometimes end up almost empty at that point. And so they consolidated a couple of barrels together, came up with these four separate batches, and then custom labeled it, which was a common thing at the time, which is not common at all anymore. Done at the Willett Distillery right around the time when they were kind of changing their guard from being just a sourcing house to what they are today, a modern day distiller and sourcing house. Like I said, kind of the end of an era. There were a number of very famous bottles similar to that. There's one called the Rathskeller Rye, the Seelbach Reserve. These were other single private labelings that were done on very, very small batch releases around the early 2000s that have all now just become insanely famous. And the prices have reflected the fame in a big way.
Apparently. So besides that, let's just not talk about the incredibly pricey ones, but the ones that are like $2,000 for anybody who's, you know, somebody's going to a store and they don't know much about a bourbon. They're not spending $2,000 on a bourbon. So what makes people want to spend that huge money? I mean, is it scarcity? Or is it a backstory or just it's iconic? And I assume taste has something to do with it.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it kind of wraps in all those things that you just mentioned. And the funniest thing about it is 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago, you could get all this stuff just walking through your liquor store and it wasn't $2,000. You know, they were on the shelves for $60, $70, $80, $100. And people thought a $100 bottle of bourbon was the craziest thing they'd ever heard then. So, yeah, it is kind of a mythical combination of the history, first and foremost. Bourbon's been made in the United States for over 100 years. It comes from several different kind of family lines. It's not a massive community of people that are involved in legacy bourbon making. So that kind of gets the folklore going a little bit. And then, yeah, over the course of the last 20 years or so, the flavor profile kind of came back in style. There was a time also in the mid-80s when you really couldn't sell bourbon much in the United States at all. Most of it was being exported to Japan, because there was a little bit more interest over there. But when things kind of finally came back around to the home front here in the States, things just started getting incredibly scarce, like you mentioned. And the bottles that you used to be able to buy for $79.99 on the liquor store shelves of basically anywhere where you would go are now incredibly impossible to find. And that's what's birthed this secondary market, which is kind of what resulted in those big prices. And so, yeah, there's more than a handful of bottles that, you know, used to be $80 that are now kind of in that $2,000 to $3,000 range. Most of them are still in production today too. One of the special things about them is every year the batches are a little bit different. There's a lot of unique characteristics that make each one kind of stand alone, which kind of perpetuates the demand for the products that still come out on a regular basis from the really famous names like your Pappy Van Winkle or the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection. But yeah, no, it is really kind of, for lack of a better word, a cocktail of the different things that you mentioned between the scarcity and the kind of folklore behind the old world business of distilling and, you know, just how much the kind of whiskey world has changed in the last, not 100 years even, but just the last 15 or 10.
Without question. And now for some of these bottles you're talking about, it's not only that you can't find them on the shelves, it's because they're allocated, right? And so explain to us what allocated bottles means.
Yeah, sure. So both restaurants and liquor stores, or what the industry calls on and off premise, has the opportunity to basically compete for allocation from the distributorships. The liquor business all across the United States adheres to a three-tiered system. It's federal law, which means that the product must go from the producer to an independent distributor and then to the point of sale. And so the very, very sought after small production products end up in this allocation system, like you said, where the point of sale owners, the restaurants and the liquor stores, are basically all in high competition to get their hands on these product where, you know, there's just not enough to go around pretty much. And so it works differently with each product. Each product kind of runs with a different distributor and they all kind of have their own systems. But the basic rule of thumb is if you do a lot of business with one distributorship and work with a lot of the other products that they sell that are maybe more high volume, you then kind of earn your way up the ladder to have the opportunity to also purchase some of the allocated stuff. And the kind of most famous scenario is with Pappy Van Winkle, which is the bourbon that everybody knows pretty much. Basically, the rule of thumb, if you want to be considered for Pappy Van Winkle, you have to buy more Tito's than anybody could ever imagine to kind of fight your way up the list. But yeah, it all works kind of amongst the distributor ecosystem pretty much. And everybody's chasing down the super small production stuff where there just isn't enough to go around.
And some of these stores then just kind of sell them even at cost to their high-end customers. And so I never see them unless I go to your auction site. So let's go back to the unicorn auction. So tell me a little bit about why you started the site.
So yeah, sure. I come from the hospitality background too. Both me and my co-founder, Cody, we worked as just bartenders back in the day. We both kind of worked our way through the industry, ended up working as spirit buyers. Cody owned a bar. I worked at a big venue. We specialized in weddings and some concerts, and there's an attached restaurant. And both in our journeys, basically managing restaurants and wine cellars and kind of bars and things of that sort, were exposed to the auction industry, mostly in the wine world first. Many years ago, I was the wine director at a French restaurant up in Evanston called Oceanique, which is a great place. Been there for 30 plus years, an amazing wine cellar, huge collection. And I was introduced to a local wine auction house then. We did some sourcing from them. We sold off some excess inventory with them. Cody as well at his bar did some business with the same wine auction house. And then also overseas in the UK, there's a handful of auction houses that do what we do with spirits. And so the industry is about 10 years old over there in Scotland is where it all kind of took off. In the States, there's not so much of a robust, dedicated spirit auction house competitive market. We're one of the few kind of devoted players towards spirits. But basically, we were kind of now and again coming across these auction markets in our day jobs pretty much. And over the course of a couple of years of kind of banging our heads together, we just kind of identified the fact that there wasn't much of a devoted option for spirits in the States. And we were kind of going out of our ways to shop overseas or maybe shop at a wine auction house to try to get whiskeys, which was not really pragmatic. They don't really focus on it. And so you don't have as much supply. The auctions that do involve the spirits were a little bit more sporadic. And working in the kind of professional world that we were in and trying to source product, you know, with some sort of timeliness, we were just kind of running into a lot of headwinds because it was such low volume opportunity and, you know, shopping overseas and stuff takes forever to actually get the product. And we just kind of experienced the demand ourselves and figured it would be worth a shot.
So the Scotch world and the wine world they've had kind of high-priced auctions for a long time. And the bourbon world is relatively new. And obviously, as you said before, it's just taken off like crazy. So fundamentally, you're basically getting your bottles from Chicagoans or people around the country. If it's a Chicagoan, they can actually just go and drop them off at your place in Ravenswood. If there's got to be another system. And then people just go on their site. The auctions last for a week and they bid. And I assume they're kind of bookended. Sometimes people get excited at the beginning and they don't do anything for a few days. And at the end, there's a rush. And then once, if you win, you either get your bottles shipped to you, you pick it up. Is that pretty much, am I portraying this relatively accurately?
Yeah, we're just a marketplace, you know. Like you said, it's really advantageous setup for people who are local and who are around here because we've got our headquarters over in Ravenswood. We're kind of easy to get to. And yeah, we try to do enough volume. Like you said, we do at least one auction every month, sometimes two, to kind of give people as many opportunities as we can to interact with some of this fun product. So yeah, that was a pretty accurate thing. It's not exactly the most complicated business in the world. You know, we're just a nice little marketplace for getting your hands on product that you can't find anywhere. And yeah, like you said, we work with private collectors all over the place.
But it's not just private collectors, because I can see your site and you can go, like, the ones that come up, they're super expensive. But then there's somebody that's just like, you know, handing off a few bottles and maybe it's $35 and people can go bid on them.
No, when we say private collectors, we mean anybody. Anybody can be a private collector, if you ask me. It doesn't matter the dollar value of what you're dealing with. And that's another thing that from the very beginning, we wanted to be part of our business was a little bit more inclusivity. That was another thing that we ran into in our experience working with other auction houses around the world was a lot of times maybe there would be dollar value minimums. And, you know, if you weren't willing to spend a certain amount of money, they wouldn't let you shop at their auctions. Or if you wanted to sell something, if you didn't have, you know, your $5,000 bottle, they really wouldn't be interested in dealing with you. And we wanted it to be a little bit more of a friendly kind of inclusive marketplace where we could work with product all across the realm of bourbon and whiskey and spirits in general. And it all kind of touches back also to what we were just talking about with the allocations and the way it works when you're, you know, a private collector trying to find a really amazing bottle through a good retail relationship. A lot of times you have to shop for a lot of other stuff too at the same time and build up collections that can, you know, be everywhere from your $50 bottles up to your $1,000 bottles. And so we think that if somebody wants to sell some items with us, we shouldn't, you know, discern away from their low end bottles and only take the good, fancy, glossy looking bottles that we can, you know, promote on Instagram. We'll take it all because that's, you know, the function of our company is we want to provide liquidity for collectors and owners of these rare spirits all over the country. And we want to obviously create the buying opportunities for the people that can't find them.
Right. And when I first went to your site, and I've been to other sites before, and I've been intimidated by the other sites. You know, sometimes they send these huge catalogs out. I don't even know. I don't want to touch them. But your site's that intimidating. It's almost, because I've dropped a few bottles off. I've purchased a few bottles from you. And it's kind of fun, right? I mean, it's kind of it's like, am I going to win this time? Where, how much do I raise? So explain to people like how it works if they want to bid on a bottle or drop a bottle off to you.
Sure. So one of the main kind of details of our auctions and auctions all across the world is called reserve pricing, which is the minimum that a bottle can sell for. And each item has its own independent reserve price at auction pretty much. And so as a shopper, if you're browsing through our options, that's one of the main things we like to recommend is make sure that you take a look at the reserve prices of everything so you can kind of see what those bare minimum sale prices are before you make your bids. Same thing as a seller. The reserve is in place to create a price floor to make sure that stuff doesn't, you know, sell for too little. We do have a lot of people who love to list zero reserve pricing on items because they like to kind of draw in the bidding a little bit earlier and, you know, let people compete and not be kind of chased away by a high price tag right away. Basically, like we mentioned before, we're kind of open to everybody, both on the buy and the sell side. There's a big myriad of price kind of discrepancy across our platform. You can kind of find stuff that's not only all in different price ranges, but stuff from all around the world, different spirit types. We try to keep it as inclusive as we possibly can. And work with our sellers to kind of give them the accurate appraisal levels that they can use to educate their reserve pricing and, you know, the details of the list that they bring to us.
I was going to bring that up because it's kind of the same thing about not being intimidated. You as a seller do not have to come up with a reserve price. You guys will give a recommended range of reserve. And then a lot of times you'll say you probably should put the reserve at this level. And I even back to that that Red Hook that was 48,500, I think your range was 20,000 to 30,000. And it's so they can quite frequently exceed.
Oh yeah, all the time. And that the Red Hook Rye also was listed with zero reserve also too, which is kind of just adds to the fun of it, if you ask me. And yeah, like you said, we like to offer recommendations on reserve pricing. We obviously try to keep reserve pricing not low across the board, but reasonable across the board. You know, everybody has different circumstances with their bottles, but we do like to incentivize the zero reserves. We have devoted auctions to zero reserve pricing now and again too, to kind of highlight bottles that people are willing to do that with, because it's just a little bit more of a fun shopping environment on the buy side. And we have our in-house experts that do our appraisals. That's kind of the first step of anybody working with us on the sell side, is we'll do free appraisals on pretty much anything, counsel them with some recommendations on reserve pricing, and then hopefully bring the product to market, you know?
And if somebody's out there and they want to just kind of like, if they want to bid, you never know. You can end up getting a great deal. Or at the very least, you'll learn, you know, if you grab a whiskey of some kind, or a tequila, or an Armagnac, or whatever, there's plenty of stuff that you have on there. You can try something new. And and even just browsing the site, I see all these bottles that some I've never heard of. There are distilleries that seem to be popping up like new ones every day. It's just a boom that doesn't seem to be slowing down.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's still a bunch that are still kind of getting their name out that have been around for a long time. That's another thing that's been really fun as our company's grown and we've seen more volume in the auctions. It's almost become a little bit educational for some shoppers, is where you can kind of browse through and see products, like you said, that you didn't even know existed. And it's not quite the same as being in a store where you're just like looking at a million different bottles and it's very overwhelming and everything's in very small print. Having it in the app format is really nice. You can kind of browse through it and kind of learn about new stuff that you don't know about. And yeah, to your first point, there are more new distilleries now than you'd think you ever seen. A lot of them distill on their own. There's a lot of them that are non-distilling producers, they call them, which is basically just sourcing houses that will buy barrels and excess stock from commercial distilleries or other distilleries all around the country. They'll bring them in, barrel them themselves. A lot of them do blending in-house as kind of like their unique selling benefit pretty much. So yeah, there's not only a bunch of new names kind of in the brand world, but also some new business models and techniques that are kind of interesting.
So I have a couple more questions just from the kind of business side, the fundamentals. You charge a 15% premium for the auction house. So whatever somebody buys, it'll be another 15%. I think you charge 5% to the seller. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's 15% buyer's premium. And then we charge 5% plus $5 per bottle to the seller.
And so when you did your first auction a few years back, what was that like when people, all of a sudden you see people clicking and bidding and winning? And that must have been so exciting.
It was exciting. And like you said earlier, we see a lot of bookended bidding on our auctions. And so everything is kind of clustered at the beginning and at the end, which in the early stages of the company was more of a roller coaster then than it is now, because we're a little bit more used to it and we have more kind of data to base ourselves on. But no, our first auction also ran for a whole month. Which is longer. So it was this month-long kind of roller coaster where we saw a bunch of action at the beginning. Everything got pretty quiet in the middle, which was a little nerve-wracking a little bit as a freshly launched company. And then obviously when we started seeing a bunch more bidding action at the end, it got really exciting. But it was a long month.
it reminds me of like, if you've ever thrown a big party, well, you probably have, you had an event business or whatever, and like you call it for 7 o'clock and nobody's there, and 7:10 nobody's there, and 7:30 and like nobody's showing up, and then all of a sudden at 8 o'clock you've forgotten why were you worried, right?
Yeah. So exactly. Awesome. Everybody comes at once, fashionably late. Hey,
that's our show this week. Special thanks to AJ Heindel from Unicorn Auctions for walking us through the market for high-end spirits. As always, we appreciate Franz Ali Marotti reporting on the top stories from the restaurant beat. You'll find her work at chicagobusiness.com. Remember to check the show notes for links to the people and places we talked about. The Dining Table with David Manilow is produced by Todd Manley at Cranes Audio Studio. Remember to follow us wherever you get your podcast, and you'll have a new episode waiting every week. I'm David Manilow. We'll keep feeding you the good things in life.